Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sparity, the podcast where we take classic literature and somehow boil it down to dead dogs and dead baby whales, like every time. I don't know why. I am here once again with Crystal.
Heyo.
And Kalina. Were you going to introduce yourself, Crystal? Go ahead. I could do it again.
I don't know. And you see, there was a really long pause. I was like, am I supposed to say more?
No, I could totally. I knew the long pause was going to happen because I didn't warn you guys. But like, yeah, I can edit that part. It's fine. All right.
No, you don't have to do it again. Do it again. Skip me.
Okay.
Hello.
Okay. we'll do it that way. All right. So I'm here with Crystal and Kalina. Hey, you guys. You're here. Good for you. Awesome. It's been a hot minute, y'all. It's been a long gap since our first episode of Frankenstein, and we're finally here with part two, which is almost certainly not going to be the last part. So this part of the book is... this is where the sad stuff happens, you guys. It's sad. And it's, it's really good, but
there
it's
was sad. Already sad stuff at the beginning. Frankenstein's not green.
Yeah.
And doesn't have staples in his head.
No staples, dead sled dogs. Oh my God, does it just get worse? Is this book a tragedy?
You know, after I read this book, I was like, I know this is supposed to be, one of the first horror books, but really it's really more of a reflection on life. It's very philosophical and it's sad. So that sounds like fun, doesn't it, everybody? Let's, you all ready to go into this book again?
Taylor said it here. Life is horror.
Life is horror.
Chapter 8. All right. Today is the trial of Justine Moritz. She's on trial for murdering William, the little 4 or 5-year-old little brother of Victor Frankenstein. He was strangled. He had a locket around his neck. They found the locket in the dress of this girl, Justine Moritz, and so she's on trial. And Victor Frankenstein and Elizabeth, his adopted sister lover, I guess, I don't know. They don't believe she's guilty at all because Justine is the nicest, sweetest girl anyone's ever met, and they think there's no way that she could have done this. Everyone loves Justine, but she's on trial.
Do we know how old Justine is?
It doesn't say. I think she's like an older teenager. I'm thinking like between 16 and 18.
Hmm.
It's kind of a guess, though.
All right.
So the whole family are witnesses because Frankenstein's dad and Elizabeth and his older brother Ernest were all out walking with William when he was murdered. So they all have to go to this. And if you remember, at the end of the first part, Frankenstein went to the place where William was murdered and he encountered his creation, his monster, out in the darkness. And he's convinced that his monster is the one that murdered William. So he's feeling pretty bad about the fact that this wonderful, beautiful girl, Justine, that they all love, is on trial for the crime that probably his monster committed. Quote, 1,000 times rather would I have confessed myself guilty of the crime ascribed to Justine, but I was absent when it was committed, and such a declaration would have been considered as the ravings of a madman and would not have exculpated her who suffered through me. End quote. So yeah, he's feeling pretty guilty. So Justine appears at the trial. She's dressed nicely. She appears calm. She appears very solemn. And the prosecutors start their case. And it's a good case. It's not looking good. Obviously, there was the locket that was on the boy that they determined to be, this was a very expensive locket, and they figured that whoever killed William was killing him for the locket. They found it in her dress. She was gone all night, the night that she was murdered, William was murdered, and she was sighted close to the murder scene early in the morning. It's a really strong case, and it's not looking good. They show the picture that was found in her pocket to Elizabeth, and Elizabeth is forced to confirm, yes, that's the one that William had, which, makes Elizabeth feel bad because she has to testify truthfully, and it is the locket. So Justine is ready for her defense. She starts presenting her defense, and at first she's pretty solid, but then she starts to get a little bit nervous and starts to mentally break. She says she was gone all that night because she was out looking for William. She says that she wasn't in town because she was staying at an aunt's house in a nearby village. She ends up staying the night in a barn. And this is an interesting quote to hold on to for later. Quote, towards morning, she believed that she slept for a few minutes. Some steps disturbed her and she awoke. End quote. So from there, in the barn, she goes to look for William again. The biggest hole in her defense is she has no explanation for why the locket was in her dress. She has no idea why it was there. And she basically kind of throws herself on the mercy of the court.
And she has no witness for her alibi either. She just except for the goats in the barn.
Yeah, right. Assuming they were even goats.
Yeah, fair.
So do we have any theories? Well, not Taylor, because he's read the book. Do we have any theories of how the locket got into her dress?
I mean, I feel like I'm leading the witness, but Frankenstein's monster murdered the boy, took the locket, and put it in the girl's dress. Or is that the ravings of a madman?
See, I want to say, like, ooh, did Frankenstein do it? Because he's like, I got to cover this up or I got to put it somewhere. And then it accidentally happens to be Justine's, like, you know, clothing. So it's like, oh, oops.
I was envisioning him like accidentally standing over her sleeping body and like dropping the locket in her dress.
I tripped and fell outside the barn and it flew out of my hand and somehow landed in the pocket of her dress.
Yeah, crazy. Exactly.
Ooh, but that is interesting because she heard footsteps, which means someone was near her. So maybe that's true. Maybe like Frankenstein's monster came over, saw her, and then accidentally dropped the locket or like put it in her pocket or something.
Oh, well, we'll have to see.
Taylor, you sound so silly. We'll have to see. You sound so silly. I don't know.
We'll have to see. I don't know. Who knows? So Elizabeth gives like this last final defense of like, hey, look, Justine is the best person ever. She can never do this. But while she's like, you know, fighting back tears, making this final defense, it's clear that the entire community is basically determined that Justine is guilty and she's going to lose. And Frankenstein is dying inside. He is so, so horrified and guilty. Quote, I could not sustain the horror of my situation, and when I perceived that the popular voice and the countenances of the judges had already condemned my unhappy victim, I rushed out of the court in agony. End quote. So that's kind of a trend with Frankenstein's character. When things get hard, he runs for his life. Like he does this a lot.
I have empathy for that.
That's so, how he gets his exercise. He runs from his problems.
Oh my gosh, I love that.
I need more problems so I can stay fit.
I call it guilt training.
Yes. This is your new workout program. I'll buy it.
So the next day, the verdict comes about. Frankenstein travels back to the court and he finds an officer there. And the officer confirms Justine is condemned to die. And the officer also says, oh, yeah, it's way easier to do these sort of terrible things when the criminal confesses. And Frankenstein's like, what? And he's like, yeah, Justine confessed. And he's absolutely baffled. He runs home and he tells Elizabeth, hey, Justine confessed. And she doesn't believe it either. And later on, they receive word that, hey, Justine wants to see Elizabeth in her final moments in her jail cell. So they go to visit. She decides to visit and she brings Victor Frankenstein with her. They visit Justine in prison and both she and Elizabeth are bawling, crying. And Elizabeth asks her about the confession. And Justine says there's basically like this Catholic priest that said, hey, look, if you don't confess, then you're going to be excommunicated and you're going to go straight to hell. And so she got scared and confessed. So Frankenstein is in the corner by himself because he can't imagine how this could be any worse. Justine notices he's there and she says, dear sir, you are very kind to visit me. You, I hope, do not believe that I am guilty. And Frankenstein just can't answer at all, right? Like he feels so guilty. He can't even speak. So Elizabeth answers for him. Listen to this quote. No, Justine, said Elizabeth. He is more convinced of your innocence than I was, for even when he heard that you had confessed, he did not credit it. And Justine responds, quote, I truly thank him. In these last moments, I feel the sincerest gratitude toward those who think of me with kindness. How sweet is the affection of others to such a wretch as I am. I feel as if I could die in peace now that my innocence is acknowledged by you, dear lady, and your cousin. End quote.
There are so many, like, things going on in this scene. Oh my god. So she knew she lied, which isn't that a sin? So, like, oh man, that was a rock and a hard place. That was not cool.
Yeah. And this just everything, this is just like it's almost a comedy of errors of how much things keep piling on to Frankenstein's guilt, almost like to purposely make it worse. To demonstrate that, quote, I, the true murderer, felt the never-dying worm alive in my bosom, which allowed of no hope or consolation. Anguish and despair had penetrated into the core of my heart. I bore a hell within me which nothing could extinguish. End quote. And the next day, Justine is executed.
What?
And that's the end of the chapter.
They execute her?
They sure do.
How?
I don't know.
Oh, it doesn't say.
It doesn't say.
No. Well, hopefully it wasn't painful. I mean, it probably was knowing the trend of this book, because they got to make Frankenstein feel extra guilty.
Judge is like, yep, the only way to execute him these days is to drag her through barbed wire. It's all we could do. What can you do? I mean, I don't make the rules.
I was thinking like, oh yeah, you know, like stoned or something. When in history has someone ever been dragged through barbed wire?
I know it's a bit unconventional, but for some reason they decided it was important. I also don't know why I, a Switzerland Geneva guard, have a Southern American accent, but here we are. Chapter 9. So as you can imagine, Victor's not doing so hot. Quote, this state of mind preyed upon my health, which had perhaps never entirely recovered from the first shock it had sustained. I shunned the face of man. All sound of joy or complacency was torture to me. Solitude was my only consolation. Deep, dark, death-like solitude. End quote. Frankenstein's father notices how sad he's being and how, you know, he's not... You know, he's being so much by himself and he's so upset. He tries to cheer him up. And he tries to cheer him up by saying, look, my son, I know you're really upset, but I loved William even more than you did. So, and that doesn't help at all, right? So the whole family decides to get their minds off this. They're all going to go retire to their lakeside house they have in a fancy place called Belle Reve. And Frankenstein thinks this is a great idea. He's made a habit of going out by himself at night. And in Geneva, they have like walls and a gate, so he can't really travel around. And out there on the lake, he can travel around. When they are on in the lake, he often goes out in a boat at night by himself and considers drowning himself like several times.
Remind me how old Frankenstein is, because I'm trying to empathize and channel the level of emotions he has. And the only thing that's coming up is like my 16-year-old self.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he's like mid-20s, right? Because like he basically finished his time at college.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Maybe he's just a late bloomer.
Men do mature slower.
That's it. That's the reason for all of Frankenstein's behavior, is that darn slow male maturation.
Yeah, the next chapter says, quote, no one understands me. I hate everybody. No,
I mean, that's kind of the subtext of everything that you've been saying about him.
I mean, yeah, that's fair. So Frankenstein thinks that, you know, hey, my creation, if it did this crime, it's likely to commit more crimes. And he's incredibly angry and hateful. He just hates this monster the more he thinks about it. Quote, my abhorrence of this fiend cannot be conceived. When I thought of him, I gnashed my teeth, my eyes became inflamed, and I ardently wished to extinguish that life which I had so thoughtlessly bestowed. End quote. Later on, Elizabeth talks to Victor, and she again accidentally makes it worse with like a bunch of ironies and that sort of thing. Victor is super rock bottom low. He can't stand it anymore. And he goes on what is this very grueling and dangerous hiking and climbing adventure, because, I mean, they're up in the Alps, in like the remote Alps. And he decides he's going to climb to this town called Chamonix, and then he's going to continue on. There's like a glacier up there and stuff. So he takes a mule, and he's going to go way out there by himself. The loneliness of nature make him feel better for a while, and eventually he makes it to the village of Chamonix. And that's the end of that chapter. Chapter 10.
Wait, sorry. He went by himself?
He sure did.
Okay.
Why, are you worried about him? Are you worried about him?
Aw, no, I was making sure because I was like, wait, how do we know he went there? But then I remembered, oh, wait, he's telling us the story of himself, so he would remember where he is.
All right, yeah, so flashback for that. The story that we're hearing now is Victor Frankenstein talking to a guy named Robert Walton on a ship, and he's like recounting his story. So Frankenstein is wandering around in the remote parts of this valley way up in the Alps. There's mountain cliffs, glaciers, distant avalanches. It's beautiful, but it's also very remote and all this stuff. And the next day, after he's been climbing for a while, it's raining really hard, and he decides he's going to summit this mountain called Montember. Sorry for a bad French pronunciation.
One more
French
time?
Pronunciation.
Montember?
Montember? I think it's Montember. It's spelled Montanvert, but, you know. So he takes his mule, he goes out to the desolate wilderness, he climbs through the beautiful nature, by noon he's at the peak, he keeps going, he crosses this glacier. It's like rough going and it's kind of dangerous, big crevasses and that sort of stuff. And he can't stop himself. If you remember, this is not the first time he's done this. Quote, "My heart, which was before sorrowful, now swelled with something like joy. I exclaimed, wandering spirits, if indeed ye wander and do not rest in your narrow beds, allow me this faint happiness, or take me as your companion away from the joys of life." End quote. So once again, out in the wilderness by himself, overcome with emotion, he yells out loud, guess what happens? Quote, "As I said this, I suddenly beheld the figure of a man, at some distance, advancing towards me with superhuman speed. He bounded over the crevices in the ice, among which I had walked with caution. His stature also, as he approached, seemed to exceed that of a man." End quote. So I wonder who that could be.
An NBA player.
From the future.
It's Karl Malone. Like, it's Shaq, and he's like, hey, buddy, you dropped this. And he just runs off.
We're getting time travel up in this business.
So he starts to become overcome with fear again, and he's feeling faint, but he has so much rage, and he's out here in the mountain air. He's like, all right, this is it. This is the final stand. I'm going to fight this thing to the death. The creature shows up in front of him, and the creature looks determined and angry, but also kind of sad, and of course, utterly, horrifyingly hideous. Frankenstein is so angry, he tells him, all right, you either get out of here or you stay and you fight me to death right now. He says he hates him, and he says the innocent lives, you've murdered them, you deserve to die, and all this stuff. And the creature responds to him. And it says, quote, no, I'm kidding. That's not what he says.
I was so excited for your Frankenstein voice that you did that, and it met all my expectations.
Now, listen to this. Okay, the creature responds to him, and it says, quote, "I expected this reception," said the demon. "All men hate the wretched. How then must I be hated, who am miserable beyond all living things? Yet you, my creator, detest and spurn me, thy creature, to whom thou art bound by ties only dissoluble by the annihilation of one of us." End quote. So it turns out he's like very Shakespearean in his speech.
Oh my
he's
God,
like really yeah. good at talking.
So the reason that no one saw him, like, all those months is he was actually, like, hidden away in the library at the college just reading Shakespeare.
Ooh, we'll see. So the monster also says, quote, "Do your duty towards me, and I will do mine towards you and the rest of mankind. If you will comply with my conditions, I will leave them and you at peace. But if you refuse, I will glut the maw of death until it be satiated with the blood of your remaining friends." End quote. So it's like oddly eloquent, but also directly threatening.
Dang, this is not how I thought this was going to go. I always thought Frankenstein like could only say a couple words and stuff. And here he is straight up like, I'm miserable. And here's a threat. And I'm going to tell you very clearly that it's a threat. Like, what?
No, I love that. That was one of the most jarring points of this book, is he speaks back and like this, you know, he's using like thou and thy, and he's like extremely eloquent in his speech. It was very off-putting.
So yeah, it just got spooky.
Yeah.
Like it went from like a slasher type thing to like a spooky, like The Ring type thing.
So Frankenstein says, you know, to hell with your threats, and he attacks him. Frankenstein jumps out and punches him, but the creature is so much more physically capable than him, he just brushes it off. And it's clear that this creature could, like, tear him to pieces if he really wanted to. The creature tells him, look, calm down and listen. And he says, quote, I am thy creature, and I will be even mild and docile to my natural lord and king if thou wilt also perform thy part, the which thou owest me. O Frankenstein, be not equitable to every other and trample upon me alone, to whom thy justice and even thy clemency and affection is most due. End quote. Bet you didn't think Frankenstein spoke like that, did you? So,
this is basically a shock.
Yeah. Frankenstein is smarter than I am by a lot.
That's what I thought too. I was like, did this guy just learn to speak like a few months ago? And like, I can't. That's why I include these quotes, because I was like, man, I can't put it as well as this person can. But yeah. So Frankenstein's basically saying, look, if you just listen and maybe give me a chance at happiness, then I'll be good, I promise. Frankenstein is having none of this. He doesn't believe him at all. The creature says, look, there's got to be a way to appeal to your good spirit. I really wanted to be good, he says, basically. But the world and everyone in it clearly fears and hates him. And he's terribly sad. He's angry. He's alone. He has no reason to be good to anyone, but he really did try to be good. And he basically says that, you know, hey, everybody, if... I'll just read this quote. Quote, if the multitude of mankind knew of my existence, they would do as you and arm themselves for my destruction. Shall I not then hate them who abhor me? I will keep no terms with my enemies. I am miserable and they shall share my wretchedness. Yet it is in your power to recompense me. End quote. He basically says, hey, everybody hates me. I have every right to hate them back, but you can fix it.
He just wants some love, but he's already on Santa's naughty list.
Exactly. He says, Frankenstein, if you'll just listen to my story, then if you still determine that I'm bad, then you can kill me after the fact. And there's this, I love this little interaction. There's this weird little funny tidbit. Listen to this. Frankenstein says to the monster, quote, be gone, relieve me from the sight of your detested form. And the creature says, quote, thus I relieve thee, my creator, he said, and placed his hated hands before my eyes. I love that bit.
What so, a smartass. Wait, but have they both seem to be pretty smart. Have they not just thought of, like, let's just put a bag on your head and then be like, look, he's got some problems, and then just, you know, assume no one's going to grab his bag because he's probably like 6'5", you know?
I thought you were suggesting, let's just put a bag on my head and then you and I could be lovers. For longer.
Hey, you know, it's 2024.
Frankenstein can love whoever he wants.
Oh my God.
It's true.
Frankenstein, you realize you just morphed Frankenstein into like an anime body pillow or like a blow up sex doll.
It's better than him going around killing people, okay?
Oh, man.
Choose body pillows, not death.
Choose body pillows, not bodies. Yes, there you go.
Man. So the creature says, quote, on you it rests. Whether I quit forever the neighborhood of man and lead a harmless life, or become the scourge of your fellow creatures and the author of your own speedy ruin. End quote. So Frankenstein decides, fine, I'll go and listen to you. He's kind of curious. He wants to hear if the monster confirms that he is the murderer of William anyway. And the monster has been speaking so eloquently that he does actually feel kind of responsible for the sadness and anger that this monster is apparently feeling. So they climb to this hut. The monster lights a fire, and Frankenstein sits down to listen to his story. That's the end of that chapter.
Oh my God, what if there's a big plot twist and Justine really did kill, what's his name? What's the four-year-old's name?
William.
William. Yeah, what if she really did? And then Frankenstein, like, saw her and was like, this is justice. So he put the locket into her dress and is like, you will get caught. And then walked away. And what if he's like really a good guy? Oh man. Everything I've known about Frankenstein has been like vastly warped. So I'm like, I have no idea what's going to happen.
Right.
Okay. So another theory, full send the other direction, where Frankenstein is absolutely awful. He murdered William, put the locket in Justine's dress to frame her so that he has a fresh body for Frankenstein to turn into a Frankenette monster.
Frankenette.
Oh my God, that's actually pretty good, though.
Wow, I love that. That's great.
Ooh. I mean, I didn't realize he was smart before, so that wasn't an option. But now that he's stinking brilliant, yeah, he's the criminal mastermind. Right? He's just going to be framing
he's
people.
He's going to figure out how to make his own anime body pillow.
I mean,
Chapter 11. The chapter starts with this, quote, "It is with considerable difficulty that I remember the original era of my being. All the events of that period appear confused and indistinct. A strange multiplicity of sensations seized me, and I saw, felt, heard, and smelt at the same time, and it was indeed a long time before I learned to distinguish between the operations of my various senses." End quote. So we're in storyception here, because this is Frankenstein's monster telling the story of his own history to Frankenstein, who is telling this story to Robert Walton on the ship. But this is the story of the monster, that he is now, from the first person, basically telling the story to Frankenstein. And apparently, early in his creation, he's like a baby, where he has, like, a hard time discerning shapes and, like, telling what his senses mean and that sort of stuff. So I was a little unclear as to whether or not this would be, like, a human who was brought back to life that had, like, their memories and abilities. But nope, he's, like, a brand new, fresh human. He's just got, like, his best base senses, and that's it. So the creature has trouble realizing what's going on. The light and the warmth of the sun are a bit too much for him. It like assaults his senses, so he kind of wanders to where it's darker. And he realizes later that he ends up in a forest. He manages to find some berries and drink from the stream. I'm not sure how he manages to do this, but apparently like his base instinct is enough to keep him alive. He has a few clothes that he found. And quote, "Before I had quitted your apartment, on a sensation of cold, I had covered myself with some clothes," end quote. So I guess he found some clothes, because we can't have naked Frankenstein wandering around, right? He finds a huge cloak discarded under a tree, and he puts it on. And several days pass where he's basically just living off instinct, trying to figure out what the hell is going on, surviving in the forest. And over time, his senses start to become a bit more distinct, and it becomes more like, you know, normal senses. Quote, "I first discovered that a pleasant sound, which often saluted my ears, proceeded from the throats of the little winged animals, who had often intercepted the light from my eyes," end quote. So this is like the level that he's at. Like, he's just realizing that birds are, like, distinct living things, and that they make sounds, and that sort of stuff. That's where, like, his brain is.
Okay. Another thing that I didn't think about at all until you talked about him finding clothes versus a naked little Frankenstein monster. Naked little Frankenstein monster. Like, do we get the impression that Frankenstein's, like, Ken doll status or more human status?
Well, there's some implications, but there, yeah, it doesn't come until later. Well, I guess we could talk about that later, but no, there's no, like, there's no, like, his enormous dong was swinging in the breeze as he wandered about. There's nothing like that.
So Frankendoll, that's what we'll assume.
You know, it helps me mentally to think of Frank and Ken doll, so that's how it's going to be in my head for now. Because
perfect.
Because other than that, like, we're all just going to be too distracted to continue. Oh my God. Okay. So in the forest, he finds this abandoned campfire. Someone apparently left his campfire burning, and he experiences warmth, and it's awesome. But, like, you know, he's mentally to the point where, like, he wants to get closer to it. So he puts his hand all the way into it and then realizes what pain is. He sees it's made of wood, and his development is extremely rapid because, you know, he's very intelligent. Remember, Frankenstein tried to make him the best human that he possibly could. So he realizes that the wood is what makes the fire going, and he keeps getting more fire to put it into the fire. He also discovers that fire can make some food better if you leave it in the fire or by the fire, right? So he kind of discovers cooking. Man, so his learning rate.
He's just zooming past all of the human evolutionary stages. He is speed running that.
He is speed running it. Absolutely.
He's the best of us.
So after a while, the berries and roots and acorns and stuff he's finding is not enough. So he's so hungry, he decides he's got to leave the forest and try some exploration. He finds this small hut and the door is open. So he goes in and there's an old man cooking breakfast inside. Quote, "He turned on hearing a noise and perceiving me, shrieked loudly, and quitting the hut, ran across the fields with the speed of which his debilitated form hardly appeared capable." End quote. So that's very cartoonish. He just walks in, old man sees him, instantly freaks out and runs for his life.
I like this visual a lot.
Yeah. He doesn't really understand why that happened, but it happened. And now he's alone with this food the guy was cooking, which is great. So he eats it. He falls asleep in the hut. Later on, he leaves and he's looking for more food like this. And he figures, well, if there's food in that hut, maybe there's food in other buildings. And he finds a village where there's a lot of buildings. And he's absolutely amazed. All the smells and all the different foods he figures are in there and that sort of stuff. And he sees, oh, there's probably people in there too. He enters one of these buildings, and as soon as he enters, a bunch of kids scream, a woman faints, and the town sounds the alarm bells. Before he knows it, the entire town has literally come out and is basically defending the town. They're all throwing rocks at him, shooting stuff at him, and throwing stuff at him, and all this stuff. So he has to run for his life. And it's at this point he kind of realizes human hatred. He kind of realizes what's going on. They're doing this because they're scared of him. They hate him. They want him to die. And that's kind of emotionally hits him pretty hard. He runs away and he finds attached to this cottage is this little hovel, like a covered pigsty, right? That's just got a dirt floor. So he dives inside and he decides basically this is where he's going to hide for now. He's in there sad about how mean everyone seems and like wondering what he's going to do. He covers the opening with stones and like, you know, makes it so that only he can get in and out. This hovel is next to the chimney of the main building, so it's warm in here, so he figures this is a pretty good place to stay. And later, while he's inside, this girl appears outside, and then a young man. They apparently live here. She has a milk pail, he has tools, he works nearby, and that sort of stuff. And he starts observing these people. There's a boarded-up window from the cottage that looks into the hovel. That's like, so basically there's a window between the building, the hovel that he's in, and the building that it's attached to, so he can see inside, because he can see between the boards, because there's a small gap. So inside, it's clean, mostly bare room with the fireplace. And there's an old man in the corner by the fireplace, and he plays the guitar beautifully. And this is his first experience with music, and it very much, you know, it emotionally affects him greatly. He hears the people talk to each other. He can tell they're making noises at each other, but he doesn't understand what they're saying at all. Quote, "It was a lovely sight, even to me, poor wretch who had never beheld aught beautiful before. The silver hair and benevolent countenance of the aged cottager won my reverence, while the gentle manners of the girl enticed my love. He played a sweet mournful air which I perceived drew tears from the eyes of his amiable companion, of which the old man took no notice until she sobbed audibly. He then pronounced a few sounds, and the fair creature, leaving her work, knelt at his feet. He raised her with such kindness and affection that I felt sensations of a peculiar and overpowering nature. They were a mixture of pain and pleasure, such as I had never before experienced, either from hunger or cold, warmth or food, and I withdrew from the window, unable to bear these emotions." End quote. This is his first experience with human affection towards other humans, and it's profound for him. Later, the young man returns, and the cottagers are all there together, and he observes them through the gap the whole time, and he just thinks they're all fantastic, they're all incredibly beautiful. And he spends the rest of his time observing them. That's the end of the chapter.
I'm starting to feel Crystal's theories right.
Oh no. That wasn't supposed to be right.
Chapter 12. He really wants to join the people inside. But he's smart enough and he has enough realization. He remembers the people he's met so far. And he knows he can't. He knows as soon as he tries to do this, they're probably going to hate him too. So instead, he decides he's just going to stay put and he's going to observe them for a while over the course of, you know, however many days. He notices they seem to follow some sort of routine. The man leaves and apparently he's working somewhere. The woman works around it in the cottage and the old man stays indoors mostly. He concludes eventually that the old man can't see. He's blind. And they all seem to really care about each other. The young people are always helping the old man, but they are often crying. and they often seem very sad. He doesn't really understand why. And if you're ever feeling bad about yourself, here's a life reflection quote for you. Quote, "If such lovely creatures were miserable, it was less strange that I, an imperfect and solitary being, should be wretched. Yet, why were these gentle beings unhappy? They possessed a delightful house, for such it was in my eyes, and every luxury. They had a fire to warm them when chill and delicious viands when hungry. They were dressed in excellent clothes. And still more, they enjoyed one another's company and speech, interchanging each day looks of affection and kindness." End quote. So yeah, that one is like, aw, I should really appreciate when someone looks at me nicely.
Yeah. Hence the philosophy on life.
I feel like he's gonna try to befriend the old blind dude because he's blind.
Oh, well, maybe.
Yeah. So he's like, hey, this one won't judge me because he can't see me.
So later he works out that, you know, they must not have access to a lot of resources. He kind of comes to the conclusion that they're poor, even though that ranking hierarchy of wealthy versus poor doesn't have any experience with that. They don't eat a lot. He can clearly tell that. And when they do run out of food, he notices that the younger people often give the older man their food. He discovers the young man is often gone to go find and chop firewood. Most of the time when he's leaving, he's going to get firewood and comes back. So during the night, he steals his tools, runs out into the woods and gathers a bunch of firewood and comes back and piles it up for them. And when they come out in the morning, they're surprised, but they're apparently happier. He doesn't understand their speech, but he can tell that they appear to be happy about what he did. Over time, he starts to figure out speech. Again, remember, he's learning turbo mode. He is very much outpacing everybody in learning speed. And he kind of deciphers some of their speech. He decides he really wants to talk, and so he needs to learn this. And he eventually figures out some words like fire, milk, bread, wood, dearest, and unhappy, and that sort of thing. And he also figures out that people have sounds that they're often called, their names. The woman's name is Agatha, the man's name is Felix, and the old man's name is only ever called, they only ever call him Father. So he spends all winter in this hovel watching these people, and every night he brings them wood, he clears the snow for them. They occasionally use words to each other that he recognizes over time, good spirit and wonderful, when they're reacting to the wood. Quote, "The gentle manners and beauty of the cottagers greatly endeared them to me. When they were unhappy, I felt depressed, and when they rejoiced, I sympathized in their joys." End quote. So he's kind of like this little family member living secretly in this hovel next to them.
And he's watching them like a TV drama show.
Yeah, he's totally the person who gets like way too invested in the characters and like wants to write them letters and stuff. Oh, yeah. No.
That's such a good analogy.
So he notices that overall they're loving of each other, but they're also kind of sad, and Felix always seems the saddest. He apparently works at a nearby farm, and he often reads out loud to everyone. He discovers what this means, that he's looking at this thing and making sounds, and so the sounds must come from the thing, the book, and he really decides he wants to do that too. He wants to read. But at this point, he still can't even understand speech. He can't understand the spoken words. But you know, he's really smart and he learns really fast. So he determines he has to learn to speak. And once he learns to speak, that'll be the first step in, you know, revealing himself. He thinks they're all beautiful and wonderful, but he's always horrified at the sight of himself. It makes him so sad. Quote, "How was I terrified when I viewed myself in a transparent pool? At first, I started back, unable to believe that it was indeed I who was reflected in the mirror, and when I became fully convinced that I was in reality the monster that I am, I was filled with the bitterest sensations of despondence and mortification." End quote. So that sucks. All winter, he's observing these people, he's trying to learn to speak. The spring comes, same routine, and he wonders more about why Felix is sad, and maybe thinks maybe I could fix it or something. Quote, "I was inquisitive to know why Felix appeared so miserable and Agatha so sad. I thought, foolish wretch, that it might be in my power to restore happiness to these deserving people. When I slept or was absent, the forms of the venerable blind father, the gentle Agatha, and the excellent Felix flitted before me. I looked upon them as superior beings who would be the arbiters of my future destiny. I formed in my imagination 1,000 pictures of presenting myself to them and their reception of me. I imagined that they would be disgusted, until by my gentle demeanor and conciliating words, I should first win their favor and afterwards their love, end quote. Oh, and that's no. The end of the chapter.
This is going to go so terribly.
For not having like a lot of human interaction and stuff, he's actually going about it in a pretty smart way, though, where he's like, I'll do favors first and then learn how to talk and then maybe I'll talk to them.
I know, which is so funny because like if a normal person do that, you'd be like, that's creepy. Why are you doing it that way? That's so creepy. Yeah, this book has like a lot of subtle themes that make you think about, you know, being attractive versus unattractive, or like, you know, behaviors that would be considered normal in certain situations, but would be like really weird in others. It makes you think a lot about that stuff.
Ooh, if he was an attractive monster, would they accept him? That's a good thing to think about. Like, ooh, would you be doing this if he wasn't ugly and looking scary?
All of the vampire shows lead me to believe that it would be fine and they would all want to sleep with him.
Right? That's the thing. Would anyone even refer to him as a monster if he was like really good looking from the get-go?
Right. Only when they, you know, see him naked and see his Ken doll. And they're like, whoa, what's up? Where is it?
Chapter 13. So he's observing them again, and Felix seems sadder and sadder over time. And then one day, someone knocks on the door to the cottage while he's watching inside. And it's this beautiful Arabian woman with a guide that's with her. Suddenly, Felix appears very happy. Quote, Felix seemed ravished with delight when he saw her. Every trait of sorrow vanished from his face. And at that moment, I thought him as beautiful as the stranger. End quote. The Arabian woman that comes is crying with happiness, too, and he learns through their communications that her name is apparently Safi, or Safi. I'm not sure. The woman apparently doesn't speak their language. She's, like, with a guide, and she, like, makes some sounds, and he can tell by the way they behave that they can't really understand each other. And he can tell that they're trying to teach her some words in their language. And the creature realizes what an opportunity this is. If they're trying to explain their language to her, then he can learn it too, if he observes. And it appears that this Safi woman is going to live with them now. And everyone appears happier. He doesn't really know why, but that's just how it goes. Over the course of a couple months, he's still living in this hovel, he's still observing them, and this Safi woman is learning more of their language, and as such, so does the creature. And the creature actually says, you know, not to brag, but I was learning it faster than she was. Summer comes, the days are longer now, which means that his time that he spends out at night in the forest, which is like the one time he can be free, gets shorter and shorter. But he has to go out at night because he's fearful of ever encountering someone in the day and then having this whole thing blow wide open. So they start to teach Safi to read and write. And the best that he can, observing through the window, the creature is learning to read and write too. There's this book that Felix always reads out loud, and this book is about history and empires and a lot of global stuff, so he's actually learning a lot of stuff about the world, too. And from this book, the creature is, like, amazed and appalled at some of the stories of powerful men, but also, like, wars and, like, how people kill each other and stuff. Quote, "For a long time, I could not conceive how one man could go forth to murder his fellow, or even why there were laws and governments. But when I heard details of vice and bloodshed, my wonder ceased, and I turned away with disgust and loathing." End quote.
This is why books and shows have maturity ratings. He was too young to be learning that stuff. Now look what it's done to him.
His delicate, moldable mind.
Yeah. He was too young to be learning about this war.
You and your Ken doll parts, boy. You're way too young.
You're not ready. Go back to the barn.
So from this book, he kind of learns of a lot of higher level concepts that he wouldn't normally know. Property, rank, royalty, laws, that sort of stuff. And listen to this one. Quote, "And what was I? Of my creation and creator, I was absolutely ignorant. But I knew that I possessed no money, no friends, no kind of property. I was, besides, endued with a figure hideously deformed and loathsome. I was not even of the same nature as man. Was I then a monster, a blot upon the earth, from which all men fled and whom all men disowned? I cannot describe to you the agony that these reflections inflicted upon me. I tried to dispel them, but sorrow only increased with knowledge. End quote. So he's really coming around to realizing what he is.
He literally just said, ignorance is bliss.
Yeah, no, he says that several times. Like, there's a quote in here somewhere where he says something like, oh, if only I had, you know, stayed in the first forest that I went to and never known anything, then everything would have been so much better.
Dang.
Chapter 14. The creature learns the full history of the people in this cottage. And he's going to tell you now. If I had one gripe against Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which I think otherwise was a really great book, the trouble with it, in a word, is pacing. In that she has like these really compelling story points and these really compelling emotions and that sort of stuff. And then she's just like, stop, hold on. We need to listen to a story for a little bit. Like back when Frankenstein was like, let me tell you the story of how my dad met my mom, which turned out to be completely inconsequential for the rest of the book. This is similar. He's like, oh, I learned the history of all the people in this cottage. And it also turns out to be largely inconsequential. So the creature learns that these people were a noble family. Of course they are. They gotta be noble. Normal peasants don't make stories. Damn it. All right. So there's this noble family last name De Lacy, and they were living in Paris. And at the time, there was this wealthy Turkish merchant who lived in Paris, too, from Constantinople. This guy became an enemy of the government. He ends up being a political prisoner. And everybody in Paris knows that it's a scam. The only reason he's in prison is because the French government doesn't like him. And he gets condemned to death. Well, Felix decides that that's not right, and he's going to save this guy. He's going to break him out of prison. And so he meets with him while he's in prison and says, you know, hey, I'm here to bust you out. And the Turkish merchant says, oh, I'll give you whatever wealth you want if you let me bust you out. And Felix, you know, is too honorable for that. He can't take his money. But he learns that this Turkish merchant has a beautiful daughter. And he's like, oh, that would be really great if I could be with your daughter. And the merchant realizes this and says, oh, I'll promise you the hand of my daughter if you just help me escape. But, quote, Felix was too delicate to accept this offer, yet he looked forward to the probability of the event as the consummation of his happiness, end quote. So he doesn't accept the, hey, straight up, I'm going to promise that I swear I'm going to force my daughter to marry you. But he also thinks maybe there's a pretty good chance it's going to happen anyway. So anyway, yeah. So Safie figures out that, hey, this guy is going to help my dad escape. She starts writing love letters to Felix. Oh, thank you so much. And the creature stops in his story, actually turns to Frankenstein and says, I have copies of these letters that I made, if you want proof, which I thought was an interesting little tidbit. But Safie's mother was a, quote, Christian Arab, end quote, that was made a slave by the Turks. And her dad eventually likes this slave and takes her as his wife. But she was from a free Christian land. So she taught Sophie about Christianity and value of freedom and independence and all this stuff. So Safie's kind of a rebel, right out of the gate. Felix breaks this merchant guy out of prison, takes the merchant guy and Safie, and they all escape Paris and they go to Italy. Right. And there they're going to wait for an opportunity for the Turkish merchant to go back to his homeland of Constantinople. And the merchant again promises, oh, yes, thank you so much. You can totally marry my daughter. And Felix and Safie are all lovey-dovey as they hang out waiting with their dad. But truthfully, the merchant hates the idea of his daughter marrying a Christian. He hates it. And he actually plans to double-cross him, to take his daughter and run away. The French government figured out, hey, there was this De Lacy family that had this son that helped this political prisoner escape. And so they imprison Felix's father, old man De Lacy, and his sister Agatha in Paris. Felix figures this out and he's like, oh no, I got to go back and save them. So he tells the Turkish merchant, hey, just leave Sophie here. I'll come back and get her, but I got to go back to Paris. Felix goes back to Paris and it does not go well. The wealth of their family was all confiscated. They get exiled and they're never allowed to come back to Paris. They escape to Germany to the cottage that they're in now. And they later find out that this Turkish merchant guy had just took his daughter and ran and left. He went back on his promise and didn't leave Sophie there at all. Sophie is really pissed. And so she escapes and decides she's going to go find Felix herself. And that was basically, eventually she ended up at the cottage. And that's the whole history of the family. And that's the end of the chapter.
Huh. That is such a plot twist, because I thought Felix and Agatha were like married or whatever. And then this other woman shows up and he's super happy. I'm like, man, this is just so scandalous.
He's like, oh boy, too.
When you said she showed up, I was like, what is this gonna be, their like servant to help or something? Is that why he's happy? Like, yeah, because I also thought they were married or like
now together. I don't need that extra anime body pillow.
it's she's finally arrived, our extra warmth for the winter.
Oh, no. Oh good, we were getting low on meat.
Chapter 15. So the monster figures out this whole history, and he feels really connected to these people. He really wants to go and be a good person with them and have them be good people to him. One day when he's out in the forest in his nighttime wanderings, he discovers a bag with 3 books in it, which is like the greatest find in the world he could possibly think of. He's so excited. And he reads them, because now he's basically figured out how to read. Yeah, this guy's learning level is off the charts. Because, I mean, he's reading, like Paradise Lost and a book called Plutarch's Lives. Like, he's reading, like, you know, some heavy classic literature. And, of course, you know, he's smart enough, he can get it.
I don't know what those are. What is their reading level? Is it, like, college?
I need probably, an equivalent reading level. I wasn't ever.
I'm not going to lie. I don't know what Plutarch's Lives is, and I don't know what Sorrow's Averter is, but I do know what Paradise Lost is. Paradise Lost is basically the Adam and Eve story.
Okay.
So, yeah. So, he describes these books in detail and, like, how they make him feel. Quote, "As I read, however, I applied much personally to my own feelings and condition. I found myself similar, yet at the same time strangely unlike, to the beings concerning whom I read, and to whose conversation I was a listener. I sympathized with and partly understood them, but I was unformed in mind. I was dependent on none and related to none. My person was hideous and my stature gigantic. What did this mean? Who was I? What was I? Whence did I come? What was my destination? These questions continually recurred, but I was unable to solve them."
Oh, dang. He's getting super philosophical now.
Yeah, yes. Yep. Now he's like the what am I, right?
If I think, right, I think therefore I am, right? He's getting into that. It's like, okay, all right.
So he also realizes that now he can read. He grabbed these papers on his way out of Frankenstein's lab, and now he can read them. And so he starts looking through them, and he realizes that one of these is actually Frankenstein's journal. And while the creature is telling Frankenstein this story, he pulls out the journal, and he's like, look, here it is.
Oh, snap.
And so, yeah, right? And so now he knows how he was created. Quote, "Hateful day when I received life, I exclaimed in agony. Accursed creator, why did you form a monster so hideous that even you turned from me in disgust?" End quote. But these people in this cottage, they're such good people. Surely they could accept him, right? So he starts contemplating about how he's going to introduce himself, but he's really nervous about it. And he also realizes that it has to go well. And if it doesn't, this might be his only chance. So he's like planning how he's going to do this for several months. He's got to get this right. And all the time, he allows his mind to drift into dreaming about, like, you know, oh, eventually we'll just all be the best of friends. You know, he's got the image of them all holding hands, running through the flowers, right? Like, he just thinks it's going to be great. The fall comes. So some of the nice weather is going away, and he desperately wants their friendship. Quote, "The more I saw of them, the greater became my desire to claim their protection and kindness. My heart yearned to be known and loved by these amiable creatures. To see their sweet looks directed towards me with affection was the utmost limit of my ambition. I dared not think that they would turn them from me with disdain and horror. The poor that stopped at their door were never driven away. I asked, it is true, for greater treasures than a little food or rest. I required kindness and sympathy, but I did not believe myself utterly unworthy of it." End quote. So it's like, oh man, buddy, no, it's like the, you know, the high school kid who really likes the girl, and it's like, oh, she doesn't like you, bro.
Oh, no.
Yeah. This is like, I feel like I'm starting to get stressed out almost, because like he's going to go and meet them and he knows them so well because he's been watching them for so long. But how creepy is it when you talk to someone? Like, it's like that stalker. It turns into that stalker trope. You're like, who are you? Why do you know that much about me? And, like, he should have just come out on day one.
Yeah. Well, gird yourself for this part here, Crystal. Gird your loins.
Oh, no.
Here we go. So,
but like it does go to the, like, he also the, like, he doesn't have great social awareness, right? Because he's never learned it. So it's like, he means well, but.
Yeah. Good job concluding this one, Kalina, because he reasons that since his appearance is apparently his biggest problem, if he introduces himself to the blind man, that'll be his best chance. So he decides that's probably what he's going to do. And a day comes when he's observing them, and Agatha, Felix, and Sophie all leave. And the old man is home alone. And the time is now. So he gets up, he's going to go, and then, like, he actually collapses in, like, fear and nervousness because he's like, I can't do it, I can't do it, I can't do it. But then he resolves himself. He's like, no, I have to. And he goes and he knocks on the door. And the old man answers. And the creature says, you know, as politely as he can, oh, he's a traveler and he would use some rest by the fire. And DeLacy, the old man, graciously says, of course, yes, come in. Yes, you're welcome in my home. They sit down. And the creature knows this is his only chance. He says that he's traveling to, quote, claim the protection of some friends, end quote, that he loves. And DeLacy is graciously listening to his story. He says that he has no family and he's an outcast. And DeLacy says, oh, cheer up, brother. Don't despair. I'm sure if your friends are kind, they'll help you. And the creature says, yes, they are kind, and I hope they will help me, but they're also very prejudiced against me for reasons I can't describe. And DeLacy, the old man, asks, well, perhaps I could help you convince your friends otherwise. You seem like a good guy. And the creature says, yeah, I'm about to try to convince them otherwise. He says, I very much love these friends and I've secretly been helping them. And, you know, I hope to, you know, I hope that helps my case. And DeLacy says, well, where are these friends? And the creature says, oh, they're very nearby. And God, can you feel the awkwardness right now?
Oh, man.
So DeLacy offers to help convince the friends. He says, oh, if you just tell me your story, stranger, then maybe I can help convince your friends that you're not so bad. You seem like a sincere guy to me. And the creature is absolutely thrilled. The plan seems to be working. And he says, quote, I trust that by your aid, I shall not be driven from the society and sympathy of your fellow creatures, end quote. And DeLacy says, what are you talking about? I would never be so cruel. Of course I'll help you. And DeLacy asks, who are these friends that you're going to meet? And the creature knows, oh man, I don't know if I can really talk my way out of this one. This is it. I've got to reveal it. But he's absolutely overcome by this moment, and he literally just starts sobbing. He just starts crying. He can't help it. And the old man is like, well, what's wrong? And then he hears footsteps outside. The other people are coming back. The monster realizes he's out of time, so he darts over to the old man, and he grabs his hand. He literally is on his knees. He wraps his arms around the old man's legs. Quote, I cried, now is the time. Save and protect me. You and your family are the friends whom I seek. Do not you desert me in the hour of trial. End quote. And the old man goes, what the hell? Who are you? What is this? And the door opens. As soon as the door opens, the three people walk inside. Agatha faints. Safie runs for her life. Felix runs up, like, kicks and attacks the creature, gets him away from his father, grabs a stick, and starts assaulting him. And the creature is absolutely heartbroken, and he just flees. He just runs. And that's the end of the chapter.
Oh, no!
He kind of blew that one. His approach wasn't super great, I'm not gonna lie.
Chapter 16. So the creature is filled with complete sadness and despair, but also rage, a sense of vengefulness. He's so emotionally distraught. He doesn't really know where to direct his emotions. He goes to the woods and he literally howls like a beast. Like, he figures it doesn't matter if anybody knows I'm here now. And he's like really yelling and howling. And eventually he collapses with fatigue. Quote, there was none among the myriads of men that existed who would pity or assist me. And should I feel kindness towards my enemies? No. From that moment, I declared everlasting war against the species, and more than all, against him who had formed me and sent me forth to this insupportable misery. End quote. So the next day, after he basically has sworn vengeance and that sort of stuff, he realizes, you know, that actually was kind of awkward. I probably could have made that work if I hadn't done what I did. And he thinks, you know, it's possible there's a way to repair this. You know, I didn't actually do anything that bad. Maybe I could fix this. So he returns to that hovel and he stays there overnight. The next day, when he's ready to, like, you know, try and reconcile this, no one's there. No one is in the hovel. No one wakes up or anything like that. And he starts to panic. He starts to get really nervous. Like, what happened? Where are they? Later, a few men show up outside and Felix is with them. They're talking about renting this building. And one of the men asks Felix, are you sure you want to do this? And Felix is clearly shaken and upset. And he responds, quote, it is utterly useless, replied Felix. We can never again inhabit your cottage. The life of my father is in the greatest danger, owing to the dreadful circumstance that I have related. My wife and my sister will never recover from their horror. I entreat you not to reason with me anymore. Take possession of your tenement and let me fly from this place. End quote. And that's the last the creature ever sees of that family.
So they abandon ship.
Yep, they basically decide this place is haunted, it's horrible, and we can never come back. So the creature is absolutely emotionally broken. Quote, I continued for the remainder of the day in my hovel in a state of utter and stupid despair. End quote. So he switches between being consumed by sadness and despair and rage and vengeance. And he's, like, constantly crying when he thinks about how kind they were to each other and then, like, how mean they were to him. And that night, he piles a bunch of brush around the cottage and he burns the whole thing to the ground.
Oh, snap. That's... wow. I didn't see that coming either.
So, now, no one can live there. Not even him.
No right. One gets to be happy.
So after he's done this, he wonders where he's going to go now. And he realizes, well, what connections do I have? What leads basically do I have? And he realizes he could find the person who created him. And that might be his best shot at anything. Kindness, resolution, revenge, vengeance, who knows? Like, his best shot is this person who created him. And he's learned a bit of geography. And somehow he has a map. They don't really say why, but he has a map. And he decides he's going to head towards Geneva, because Geneva was mentioned in Frankenstein's documents, and he figures he lives in Geneva. He travels for a very long time. He travels only at night. He's unable to ask anybody for directions, so he's literally making it up as he goes. And it takes him a really long time. One day, he has to travel through this really thick forest, so he determines, hey, I can travel by day, no one's going to see me in here, and it makes him feel better. In fact, it makes him feel so much better that he almost, like, changes his ways. Quote, half surprised by the novelty of these sensations, I allowed myself to be borne away by them, and forgetting my solitude and deformity, dared to be happy. Soft tears again bedewed my cheeks, and I even raised my human eyes with thankfulness towards the blessed sun, which bestowed such joy upon me. End quote. So, at some point, as he's traveling through the forest, he comes upon a river. Like a really fast rushing river, and he hears some voices. So he hides. And suddenly this young girl appears, and she's running along the riverside, laughing. Apparently she's running away from somebody playfully. She trips and falls, and she falls in the river, and the river just rips her away. And with his better emotions and, like, maybe thinking, you know, things aren't so bad, he jumps in and saves her. He swims very strong because he's super athletic, and he drags her to the shore. She's unconscious, and he's, like, trying to revive her. And another man, that apparently was the man she was running from or something, spots them. And of course, he's horrified. He shoves the creature away, grabs the girl, and runs. The creature follows him. Quote, I hardly knew why, end quote. But he's following this person like, hey, hold on, I just saved her, or something like that. The man sees he's following her, turns around, pulls a gun, and shoots him.
Oh, no!
Oof.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's what he gets for helping. Eventually, he gets shot in the shoulder, and the wound is, you know, it's not good, but he's a really big, physically strong, capable individual. He does faint, but eventually he wakes up, and then he lives in the forest for some weeks, recovering from this wound. Quote, my sufferings were augmented also by the oppressive sense of the injustice and ingratitude of their infliction. My daily vows rose for revenge, a deep and deadly revenge, such as would alone compensate for the outrages and anguish I had endured. End quote. So now even like the sunlight and the birds and stuff doesn't even make him happy. Now he's like so cynical and so upset that there's no happiness for him at all.
Man, this guy has just had a stroke of bad luck.
Yeah.
And you could call it that.
And I'm trying to imagine how terrifying something has to be before, like, I shoot them first and ask questions later.
Right. Makes you wonder if someone's just like really unfortunate looking at this time period. They're just like, oh, blam.
He could also talk too, though. So it's like, you know, it's not even like he could be like, wait, hold up. You know, it's not even like grunting noises where you don't know what he's saying. So like on top of that, it's like, wow, people are really jerks. But yeah. I still stand by my bag idea where he should have bagged his face. Like, I think that would have been the smart move.
You know, I wasn't on board with the bag idea to begin with, but now I really am. I think that's the move. Know, right?
You should make a fan fiction called The Bag of Frankenstein.
Frankenstein's bag. Yeah, I love that.
All right. So he recovers from this wound. And he keeps traveling, and eventually he makes it to Geneva. And he considers what he's going to do now. One day, while he's sleeping out in the woods close to Geneva, a child comes up running and discovers him. And it occurs to him, hey, children are new to the world. They're easily influenced. They don't really know ugly from good looking that well, right? Quote, suddenly, as I gazed on him, an idea seized me that this little creature was unprejudiced and had lived too short a time to have imbibed a horror of deformity. If, therefore, I could seize him and educate him as my companion and friend, I should not be so desolate in this peopled earth. End quote. So he grabs the kid. He's just going to kidnap him. And as soon as the kid sees him, of course, he's terrified. He's covering his eyes. He's screaming. And the creature tells the kid, hey, look, I don't want to hurt you. Calm down. And the boy is yelling at him that he wants him to let him go. He says, oh, you're hideous, you're ugly, you're an ogre that wants to eat me. And, you know, the monster is saying, hey, look, calm down, I just want you to be my friend. And the boy says, my papa will punish you. My papa is Monsieur Frankenstein, and he'll punish you. And the monster goes, you're Frankenstein's son?
Oh.
And grabs him around the throat and kills him.
What?
Quote, I gazed on my victim, and my heart swelled with exultation and hellish triumph. Clapping my hands, I exclaimed, I too can create desolation. My enemy is not invulnerable. This death will carry despair to him, and a thousand other miseries shall torment and destroy him. End quote. So the creature sees the locket around his neck and sees, oh, there's a picture of a really pretty woman in here, and he grabs it.
Oh no! Taylor, stop and it!
He's looking for a hiding place, and he finds this barn. And in this barn is a sleeping young woman.
No!
And he decides, this person is as good as any to suffer for the crime that I committed, and he puts the locket in her dress.
No! And runs away. How could you?
So at this point, the creature telling the story to Frankenstein, his story is finished. And he ends with this, quote, we may not part until you have promised to comply with my requisition. I am alone and miserable. Man will not associate with me, but one as deformed and horrible as myself would not deny herself to me. My companion must be of the same species and have the same defects. This being, you must create. End quote. And that's the end of the chapter.
Me and Crystal are sitting here like shocked Pikachu face, like...
Oh, that no. Is so accurate. That's literally my face right now.
I didn't think that he killed the boy.
Yep. Eventually he says, I did it. And he's not even sad about it, right? Yeah, you guys were right about a lot of stuff, actually. Good job, team. Because, yeah, no, it worked out that way. And he definitely wants his what did you call it? Frankenette. He wants his Frankenette.
We didn't want to be right, Taylor.
But you were, and I hope you're happy with yourselves. All right, everybody, that was episode 2 of Frankenstein. And if you're enjoying it so far, then we have one more episode upcoming to do the last part of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Big oof.